The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. So this morning, are you able to hear me? Is this okay? Okay. This morning, I thought of seeing if I could talk a little bit shorter. Let's see if this works. And then have a little more opportunity for discussion. Maybe turn that just up a little bit. How's that? There we go. Now I hear it. Okay. So what I thought of talking about this morning is suffering. And how we can use suffering as a guide, as a kind of a teacher, as a way to orient. So I've kind of, my own title for this talk is Reorienting Around Suffering. So to talk about this, I feel like I need to at least to begin by putting a context around what I mean by suffering and what is typically understood by the term dukkha, which is the usual, the suffering is the usual translation of that Pali term, dukkha. But the translation of suffering is, it's a little bit narrow in a way for what dukkha actually conveys. Dukkha is understood to be the kind of reactivity around our experience. One way that Gill sometimes puts it is that we experience pain in our lives. You know, there's going to be pain in our lives. We're going to have accidents. There's going to be loss. There's going to be pain that comes in, especially through the physical body. And that is not what is meant by dukkha. So, you know, you break a bone, or you get in a car accident. The physical pain of that is not what is meant by dukkha. So, you know, the understanding in this tradition that we can be completely free of suffering doesn't mean we're going to be free of that kind of pain. So Gill sometimes says it, you know, pain is inevitable in our lives. We will experience pain. Suffering is optional. And that is the reactivity around that inevitable pain. So that's one way of thinking about this word dukkha, that it is this reactivity to our pain that causes this suffering. So there's a couple other translations for this word. I mean, suffering is the most common one that is used. Yeah, I actually like to use dukkha when I can, because suffering, even just the word suffering, I think, makes us think of certain things. And so using the word dukkha, we can begin to have another understanding about what this actually means. Another translation that Tanasaro Bhikkhu uses is stress, which conveys the notion or the idea that it's a mental thing that's going on, that it's a mental kind of reactivity, and the fact that it can be quite subtle. You know, this dukkha isn't just about large kinds of reactivity. It can also be quite subtle. So stress conveys kind of the subtlety of that, and the fact that it is mental, more that the dukkha that is being described is a mental experience, not a physical one. But even stress to me seems like it doesn't really cover the range. Another way to look at this is to look at what the word dukkha, the kind of root of the word dukkha. And the do part of this word means bad. And the ka part, my understanding is that it basically means the space in the, one of the ways that it is understood is it means the space in the middle of a wheel, or the empty space in the middle of the wheel, or kind of basically the axle, you know, the place where the axle would go. And so, you know, if you have a wheel with a bad empty space in the middle, or an, you know, it may be off center, or it may be out of round or something. So, you know, that wheel will kind of give you an uncomfortable ride. It'll be off balance. It'll be off kilter. And that's another way to think of dukkha, you know, the sense of out of balance or off center. That even conveys some of the subtlety also, that any way that things just feel off, even the littlest bit, is this sense of dukkha. Another way to understand this word dukkha, and there's different ways that this term is used actually in the discourses. It's used to mean the actual experience of suffering, of stress, the actual reactivity around our experience. That's one way that this term is used. And another way that it's used is as what can be called it's often talked about as a characteristic of all experience. And so this is a different use of the term, and I want to clarify this because it again points to kind of a subtler way that we struggle and that we suffer. So when dukkha is talked about as being a characteristic of all of our experience, it doesn't mean that everything we experience is unpleasant or is that has that experience of stress or suffering. What it means is that everything that we experience is unsatisfactory as a place to hang our hats on and say, this is what's going to do it for me. This is how I'm going to be happy. So everything, there is nothing in our experience that is, and the reason why this is so is because of this truth of impermanence. Because everything in experience comes and goes. There's nothing that lasts for, even for more than a split second, actually, when we really see it. I mean, there's some things that feel like they last, like relationships feel like they last, or possessions feel like they last, but everything is in the process of change. There's nothing static about what we experience. And so that if we are holding on to or trying to say, this is what's going to do it for me, it's going to be unsatisfactory. There's an unsatisfactoriness to that thing. That it's not, the thing itself can't be a source of happiness. And so that's another translation of this term is unsatisfactoriness. Things are unsatisfactory. But the experience of dukkha, the experience of suffering, is mostly what the path of our practice is designed to help us with. So this reactivity, and just to basically, you know, as a very, you know, I talk about this a lot, so just as a very quick review, when things are unpleasant, we don't like them, we don't want them, we want to get rid of them. There's this aversion, this pushing away. That's a form of suffering. The wanting to get rid of things that are unpleasant in our experience. It creates the reactivity of anger, of frustration, of irritation, of annoyance, of rage, of hostility. Perhaps even of depression or sadness if we can't get rid of the thing that we want to get rid of. And if things are pleasant, we like them, we want them, we want to hold on to them. And that can lead to, you know, the feeling, again, you know, if something's pleasant and we can't get it, there's the feeling of dissatisfaction or struggle. If something's pleasant and we get it, we hold on to it, there's this moment of feeling like, yes, oh, things are good now. And in that, yes, things are good now, there's kind of like, oh, that's where we're hanging our hat. It's like, yeah, okay, now I've got it. Now I've figured it out. I'm going to be happy for the rest of my life. I've actually had that thought. Ah, now I understand. Now, never going to suffer again. When we hold on to things, there's the suffering around the, you know, thinking that it's going to last and the fact that it will go away. There can also be a kind of suffering around a fear that it will go away, even as we have it. You know, kind of fear that somebody's going to come along and take it away from us. So this kind of reactivity around our experience is about, you know, not being oriented to what's actually happening. You know, not being able to accept what is actually happening for us in our experience. So this kind of reactivity is in the territory of how we relate to our experience. So we experience something unpleasant. We cut ourselves with a knife. And there's the pain of that, you know, the pain of that physical damage to the body. And then there is the reactivity around it. The Buddha talks about this as extra, you know, so this is where the optional comes in. He gives an analogy of somebody who is stabbed by a dart, and that's the first pain that we experience. You know, there's the pain of the actual pain of the cut or the damage to our body. There's that pain. And he says, and when that happens, what we do is it's like we pick up another dart and stab ourselves again. It's like, oh, that was so dumb, and what am I going to do now, and I haven't got time for this, and it's like, it's already happened. It's here already. The movement is, can we begin to acknowledge what has happened and respond rather than react? I think that's a good way to think about it. It's how can we be responsive rather than reactive? Can we respond skillfully out of compassion, out of kindness, out of caring, rather than out of aversion or hostility or greed? So this reactivity is kind of grounded in a wanting things to be other than they are. So this wanting, and if you look at your own experience, you'll see this. You'll see that when there feels like something's off, there's something that we want. And I'll go through some of the ways that we do this in a minute. So there's some kind of wanting happening. And the wanting is the cause of our stress, our suffering, our dissatisfaction, this out of kilter feeling. The wanting things to be other than they are is the reason why things feel off. It's the wanting itself. If you even just do a kind of a thought experiment for yourself, you know, if you are in a situation where things are a certain way and you don't like them, you want to change them, if that wanting were to go away, would there be a problem? So it's the wanting that is the cause of that feeling that things aren't right. Now, this doesn't mean, I have to say this every time I talk about this, because often this is misinterpreted and misunderstood to mean that when something, you know, so I say, you know, wanting to change something or wanting to fix something, that's the source of our suffering. It's the wanting that's the problem. it's not, this doesn't mean that we don't take action to fix something or change something. But where the suffering comes from is the, first of all, it's the not wanting it to be like this now. It's already like this. So, I mean, that's, so there's the resistance to things as they are now. That's a great part of our suffering. And then there's this sense of demand that it has to be changed and that we have to change it in a certain way. So we have a kind of an agenda around that change. So it doesn't mean this teaching on the wanting is the suffering or the craving to change things or fix things or have things. It doesn't mean that we don't act to eat, to get ourselves out of a dangerous situation. It doesn't mean that we don't act. But can we act not out of that feeling of aversion and things have to be different, but more out of a sense of compassion, of kindness? So this teaching on the wanting being the cause of suffering is often, people often think, well, all I'm supposed to do then is just sit there and let things roll over me, and that doesn't feel good. And that is not what the teaching is. We do need to look at where we are reacting, and can we meet that reactivity? That's another aspect of this teaching. It's not that we're trying to get rid of the reactivity either. We're not trying to get rid of suffering. We're trying to understand suffering. The understanding is how the transformation begins to happen. It's kind of a paradox in a way. You know, we if we want to get rid of something, if we want to get rid of suffering, if we are orienting our attention towards, I don't like this thing and I want to get rid of it. You know, like anger's coming up. You know, if we don't like our anger and we want to get rid of our anger, we're adding aversion to anger. That's another second dart. That's another arrow. And so we kind of need to explore our suffering in a more organic or internal way, not in terms of thinking, okay, how can I get rid of this suffering? How can I understand it? There's this kids game that I remember from when I was, you know, I was probably in kindergarten or something, and we did this like going on a lion hunt. Do you remember that? Going on a lion hunt. And then you come to this big field and it's like, oh, can't go around it, can't go under it, can't go over it, gotta go through it. And then you come to a river and you can't go over it, can't go around it, can't go under it, gotta go through it. And then a swamp. It's like this with our suffering, that part of the movement is to move into and through it as a way of understanding it. So using suffering as a guide, you know, that why, how does that work, or what do I mean by that? The fact that it is our wanting that is the source or the cause of the suffering means that any time there is suffering, there's something that we want. That is, anytime there's this kind of mental suffering, this kind of stress, or, I mean, I'm not talking about the physical pain again. So anytime there is dukkha, anytime we're experiencing dukkha, there's some kind of wanting going on. And this wanting is optional. The dukkha is optional. And so exploration or using suffering as a guide means that suffering points us to where we are clinging, where we are holding, where we are trying to make things, where we're not aligned with things as they are. So suffering is a direct pointer to us for how can we begin to let go. So in this path, I mean, the Buddha talks about the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. He talks about these as being the entirety of our practice. This is what we study, and the outcome of that study is understood to be ultimately complete freedom from this dukkha, from this kind of mental suffering. There's one description of a completely freed mind that says, what is this freedom? Someone who has this kind of freedom experiences no mental pain or grief. That's the understanding. No mental pain or grief. It sounds pretty amazing. And that's the exploration. But we don't just get there by, you know, wishing to be there. We get there by understanding suffering, by going through it, by really beginning to learn about it. And not with the agenda. I mean, there's paradoxes in the path of practice. The direction of practice is towards freedom from suffering. And yet we can't want it. So it's kind of a paradox. I mean, we kind of want it in a way. There's a way that we orient ourselves in that direction. And yet if there is a craving around wanting to be free of suffering, that very craving is what we need to look at and what we need to recognize as suffering itself. So there's sometimes an understanding, or sometimes I hear people say, you know, oh, we get the lessons that we need. And I think this is really true, but it's not that the universe out there is somehow conspiring and planning to give us the lessons that we need. It's our own minds that give us the lessons that we need, because it's our own clinging that we rub up against the world, and we meet our own clinging and our own struggles. And that's why we get the lessons that we need. And so that's kind of the exploration here. So looking at suffering, you know, what do I want in this situation? I just kind of thought for myself of ways that I want things, ways that I suffer. And I came up with this whole list of questions that I find interesting to think about. So just asking the question, what do I want in this situation when there's a feeling of dukkha? What do I want here? That's a great doorway into the kind of thing that we are actually holding on to. What is it that I want in this situation? So I came up with a whole bunch of different ways. You know, do I want to have something? You know, I want to have something that I don't have. Do I feel like, oh, that thing, that's that electric car, that will make me happy, because then I'm not going to have to spend so much money on gasoline and I'm not going to go broke. Do I want something? What is it that I want? And what's kind of underneath that? I mean, that's just kind of a silly, simple example in a way. But, you know, looking underneath that, what do I want? Oh, I want that electric car. And then, you know, underneath that may be a sense of fear, of insecurity around finances, because gasoline is so expensive that, you know, I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to afford to drive my car, you know. So there's a sense of fear and insecurity under there. So, you know, making it not just a surface exploration, but where's the actual struggle going on? And this is an investigation. This is an investigation of our suffering. This is what I mean by going through. So can we begin to understand what is actually underneath this sense of dissatisfaction, of wanting. Do I want to get rid of something? This is a big one for me. I seem to orient my life around getting rid of things. It's like, if I can only get rid of all of these things, then I'll be happy. So do I want to get rid of something? Do I want to fix or change something? For me, that's very associated with the wanting to get rid of. Do I want to fix or change something? Do I, and kind of related to that also is, do I want to not be here? You know, so that, you know, the sense of wanting to fix or change something, including me getting out of the situation. You know, do I want to flee somehow? Do I want to be seen? Do I want to be recognized? Do I want to know what to do? Getting a little subtler in here. So for me, this comes up in a place of a feeling of this, the struggle around transitions, when we're in a kind of a place of not sure what the next thing is, that place of feeling a discomfort around not knowing what the, and so there's a feeling of, there's the fear around not knowing, there's the wanting to get rid of the not knowing, there's the wanting to know what I'm going to do next. So that place can include both of that, wanting to have something and wanting to get rid of something. So do I want to know what to do? Do I want to be someone? So many different subtle ways that we can suffer. Do I want to be the one in charge? Do I want to be, or maybe I want to be the one in the background. Maybe I want to be the one who's invisible. Or maybe I want to manifest a certain quality. I want to be peaceful. I don't want to be angry. Maybe I want to be peaceful. So when there's a struggle, what is it? What is it that we want? What do I want? What is it that I want right now? Then there can be even some subtler forms of wanting that I think get exposed in a way as we practice. For me, at least, these are kind of around the practice itself. You know, some subtler kinds of suffering around the practice itself, and there's some larger sufferings around the practice itself. Just as I described earlier, and, you know, as we start to recognize our own contribution to our suffering, as we start to see that it's the mind that's doing it. It's our mind that creates the anger. It's not the thing out there. There's a thing out there that's happening that we don't like, and then we respond and react internally that creates the anger. And as we begin to pay attention with mindfulness, we feel the anger itself. We turn towards it. We orient towards the going through the anger. We don't like it. It doesn't feel very good. And we want to get rid of this anger. And they're suffering around that because the processes seem to unfold in their own time. And so we really need to have the kind of patience around going through our suffering. If we have an impatience or a sense of wanting to get rid of or dissect this part of myself out and just forget that part, I want to get rid of that part. If we have that kind of a view around our own experience, there's going to be suffering there. So there needs to be a kind of a balance of mind around being with suffering. We can open to a little bit of a space around the suffering if we can be balanced, if we can be non-reactive to the suffering itself. And in that movement, we've moved into a place where that we can go through it. When there's less reactivity to the suffering, it's a little bit easier to be able to move through it. But then there's some even, around the practice, there's some even subtler forms that I see in my own experience of, you know, this teaching around understand suffering. We can latch onto that too. And I see, you know, something comes up in my experience where there's a little bit of suffering, and it's kind of like, oh, there's some suffering. I'm going to look at that. And, you know, it's almost like holding on to it in order to observe it. And I see, so this really, this came up for me the other morning. I could see this like, ooh, look at that. And it's like, oh, why am I doing that? You know, and letting go of that, wanting to observe it, wanting to understand it. It just kind of went kind of in a kind of amorphous way. It just kind of flowed through and changed. And then there was something else. It's kind of like, so we can have that, ooh, this, we put it on a microscope, you know, it's like, this is what I need to look at. This is what will make me happy, understanding this. And so it's a subtler kind of craving that we move to in the practice. Sometimes as we experience things, we begin to see a kind of clarity that comes as we are mindful. That we see, oh, you know, when I'm mindful, things are very clear. And sometimes we get into spaces in our meditation where things aren't clear. And we don't know what's happening to us. And we don't, it's like, what is happening here? This is nothing I've ever experienced before. And there's this wanting to know. Wanting to know what's happening. That can also be a form of suffering. Rather than just being willing to be with, I don't know. I don't know what's happening. So I'm going to just say a couple more pieces and then open it up for questions. One is that, suffering, we often think of suffering. The term suffering often conveys something kind of large. We think of it as our big sufferings. And again, as I said, stress or out of balance, those convey the subtler areas. But one thing that seems to be the way our minds work is that the smaller kinds of suffering that we have, the ones that we don't get quite so out of balance around, but we notice that, oh, things are a little off here. Don't quite like the way things are going right now. But it's not like we're really like thrown off. It's just, yeah, things don't feel very good. The smaller ones are kind of a very similar pattern to the larger ones. So for myself, for instance, you know, I notice that sometimes when I'm ending something small, ending a shower, you know, I notice a little bit of impatience. You know, it's like, just get on with it. Get to the next thing. A little bit of impatience at the ending of something. And that pattern of impatience at endings becomes quite strong when there is a major ending happening. And a lot more kind of suffering in that area. So, you know, the ending, the first 3-month retreat I did, it's like, this is a major ending. 2 weeks before the retreat ended, I was so impatient. I was like, just get me out of here. You know, it's like, I want to get over this transition. I want to just be in the next thing. And the suffering around that impatience was quite strong. So this, what to me this points to is that our patterns, we each have our own patterns, our own familiar ways of being with things. And the patterns are similar, whether we're reacting to something small or something big. And so this is helpful for us to recognize because we can look at the smaller struggles and learn about our minds. It's much easier to be willing to be present for the impatience of finishing a shower than it is to be willing to be patient for the present for the impatience of a larger transition. There's more threaten. There's more of a sense of threat or insecurity or instability in a large transition. You can be with it, you can work with it, but there'll be times when you get caught. If you are willing to really use your smaller sufferings as a teacher, as a guide, you will learn a lot about the way your mind works, and it will serve you as you move into other areas that are not so minor. So use the smaller ones as a training, as a guide. The other thing I feel like I need to pull in as a piece around this using suffering as a guide is that it's not our only our own suffering, our own dissatisfaction, our own struggle that we should use as a guide. We also need to look at how what's happening in the world. So if we're moving in the world and behaving in the world, if there's suffering happening around us, even if we're not suffering, if there's suffering happening around us, is there something that we don't know or don't understand that needs to be understood? So this is kind of in the area of unmasking delusion, unmasking misinformation or misunderstanding. So if there's suffering happening around something that you're doing, even if your intention is good, it can be helpful. I mean, not just to simply say, well, my intention was good. You know, if they're reacting, it's their problem. You know, there is something to that in a way. I mean, we can't take on the feeling of guilt that, you know, oh, I did something bad. It's not that. It's not that we're taking on their suffering. But is there something to learn? Is there something to understand that we didn't understand? So an example of this. It's kind of a famous story of a naturalist who, when he was young, he was fascinated by nature and he had this butterfly collection or this, you know, the chrysalis collection. He had a collection of these caterpillars that had turned into the chrysalids. And one day he saw one of the chrysalises opening. And he watched while it opened, and he saw it crack and split, and the butterfly began to emerge. And there's all of this, you know, effort that the butterfly put into emerging from this cocoon. And it struggled and, you know, and kind of got all wet. This kind of fluid came pouring out. And the young 11-year-old naturalist watching this felt compassion for the suffering of this struggling being. And as the other chrysalids started to crack open, he thought, I'll make it easier for them. I'll open that crack a little bit so they don't have to struggle so hard. And what happened was that those butterflies kind of slid out of the cocoon, fell on the ground, and walked around and died. And he, in his years later, when he was in his 70s, he was talking about this as one of the central lessons he felt he learned as a naturalist, that he felt like he was being kind. And yet because he didn't understand what had to happen as the butterfly emerged, it had to make that effort in order to have that fluid go over its wings so that it could fly. If it didn't make that effort, it wouldn't be able to fly. And he said, you know, what seems to be kind and is intended as kind, maybe the reverse. And so this was an area where he didn't have the information. His intention was kindness and compassion, but he didn't know. And so this isn't something to say, oh, I'm such a bad person, beat me up. It's like, no, learn from this. Learn from the, what is it that I didn't know here? So this is another place of exploration when there's suffering in the world. Is there something that we didn't know or need to learn, need to understand? So basically using this reflection on suffering, on our own suffering, and on how suffering results around us, as a teacher. We use it as a teacher, as a guide. What is it that we need to learn? What is it that we need to understand? So, any thoughts or comments? Or yeah, Jen.
Thank you so much for the talk, because I've been looking at suffering quite a bit, and I have two specific questions. One is, I love how we talk about when I'm suffering in particular, I'm looking for something to hang my head on. I'm like, oh, you know, where's the where's the end to the suffering? And one of the ways I do that, because of my experience, is the refuge. You know, I take refuge in the Dharma, the Sangha, and the Dharma, the Sangha. What was it?
The Buddha.
The Buddha. I always think of the Buddha and the Dharma, the same thing. But you know, I've just noticed lately that, well, I even have clinging with that, like, oh, I'm just going to take refuge there. Like, I want to hang my hat there. And, you know, I there's that, again, there's that balance between, oh, there's the place I can rest.
Yes.
And just watching will be, you know, be a little bit mindful of how much you're trying to rest there.
Yes.
Because that changes, too.
Exactly.
And so that's been...
So, you know, you point to something really important, I think, and that is, you know, this practice around looking at suffering and wanting in particular, you know, the wanting to be at ease, is kind of it's a staged thing. You know, it's like we can begin to get over or to let go of hanging our hat on sense pleasure or fixing and controlling and changing the world. And one way or one step to doing that is to take refuge. You know, that we see, okay, you know, maybe the practice can really help me here. And so we begin to want to do the practice and we want to take refuge. And that serves us. It serves us really well to help us let go of some of the more difficult things. And at some point, that wanting to do the practice, that wanting to essentially control our experience through mindfulness, it begins to be felt as suffering. So, you know, initially that movement to be mindful and to want to be mindful when we're experiencing anger or aversion or something like that movement to want to be mindful. Initially, it creates a space and it's like, oh, okay, this is helpful. And we know we're headed in the right direction. At some point, the wanting around the practice itself will be felt as suffering. Don't worry about it if it's not felt as suffering. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, I can take refuge here. But as soon as you start to recognize there is suffering around that wanting to hang my hat on that, that's when we, again, use suffering as our guide. That points us to the next kind of place that we need to go. What is it that we need to look at there? And again, it's not trying to get rid of it. It's more about exploring it. And it is just... Yep, I see. I really want to hang my hat on this. And what does that feel like? Where's the suffering there? You know, is it intellectual or is it actually felt? I mean, sometimes we can get an intellectual kind of suffering. It's like, well, I know this is impermanent and we talk ourselves into suffering because we know it's impermanent, as opposed to actually being able to feel it. So is it coming through an intellectual reflection or is it actually being felt as suffering? That's another place to explore.
Thank you. And then my last question, and maybe we can talk about this after, but it's, I agree with you about, you and Gil both, I've heard, you know, pain is
inevitable
and suffering is optional. Although I just got an email yesterday, and I also just did read that the Buddha described three types of dukkha. And the first one is the pain of emotional and physical suffering, the second being impermanence, and the third being the anxiety that we feel that the future events, you know, are we going to be able to X, Y, or Z? So I just wanted to make sure I'm a little now confused about... When he was talking about the pain, physical and emotional, was he talking about that second arrow maybe, or was he just trying to more define, fine-tune?
So, yeah, the three kinds of dukkha, one way I like to look at them is the first one, the dukkha around pain, is the dukkha around our response to unpleasant experience. And that might be physical unpleasant experience or mental unpleasant experience, and it's the response.
It's the
It's the response. Okay. It's not the physical unpleasant experience itself that he's talking about. Now, the understanding is that as we, at least my understanding is that, you know, that mental unpleasantness, you know, there's physical pain and there's mental pain. And the physical pain is inevitable. The mental pain is optional. And in the description of what I said, you know, the Buddha said that an arhant, someone who's fully awakened, experiences no mental pain or grief. That's no mental pain or grief. None. That's like not even, you know, if you're feeling, it's not that they're, you know, you're not reactive to anger. You don't even have anger. It's not that you're reactive to grief. You don't even have grief. So that's a long way off. So, you know, the way to really think about it is not that, you know, the mental reactivity is optional. That means it's bad. That means the way to explore it is, and how am I reacting to that reaction? How am I reacting to that mental experience? So that's the mental pain and grief. And just to briefly talk about the other two, the second is the reactivity around impermanence, or the suffering around impermanence. It's the suffering that's inherent in pleasant experience. And in a way, this is like, you know, this is what I was talking about, that unsatisfactoriness, that the pleasant experience is bound to end, and that there will be suffering that results from that. So the second kind of suffering is the suffering that comes with pleasant experience. It's kind of the hidden suffering of pleasant experience, that it is inevitable. It is the unsatisfactoriness. And then the third one is, you know, we've talked about pleasant, we've talked about unpleasant. The third one is kind of our response to neutral experience. This is one of the ways it's described in one of the commentaries, that, you know, it's like when there's not much pleasant happening or unpleasant happening, there's just neutral experience. What's our response there? And a lot of times it's kind of like, well, is this all there is? You know, there's just this, you know, the kind of taking care of our bodies is, you know, it's kind of this endless trying to keep up with things so that there won't be pleasant or unpleasant. In a way, you know, like okay, what do I need to do here? I need to get up, I need to take a shower, I need to go to work so that I can earn some money, so that I can buy some food, so that I can make my food and eat the food, and so that I can, you know, take care of my family, and then, you know, come home and talk to my partner, and then I go to bed, and then I get up, and I do it all over again, and again, and again, and we do this every day until we die, you know, it's just, that's... That's what we do. And there's a kind of a feeling of, and is this it? You know? Is this what life's about? So I think of this third kind of dukkha as the Buddhist version of existential anxiety, you know. And it's that kind of subtle kind of, what's the point here? Yeah, Bill.
Well, when I participated in the week-long retreat a couple weeks ago, I picked angry reactivity as something I wanted to work on. And I did, I certainly know, looking back on it and using your language of today, that I wanted to get rid of it. And I wanted it to go away right away, of course. And it didn't. It hasn't. I did begin to see that in many cases I set myself up for that by thinking I'm superior or deserving of something or whatever.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
That's good. I mean, to see that.
It's great to see it.
And since the retreat, I've uncovered all sorts of things in my history where I repeated that pattern over and over and over again. And now I don't know where to go with it. I'm just sort of sitting with it, if I can. And sometimes getting annoyed that I know so much more about it.
Well, so what you're pointing to, I mean, I there was a place I decided to cut something out of the talk so that I could talk for shorter. And this talking about the conditions in the history was one of those. And, you know, so this is an interesting piece for us, you know, that our suffering comes together in the moment through a kind of a wanting that's happening right now. And yet there's all kinds of conditions from history that have set us up for this. You know, there's our conditioning from when we were a child and the way we responded and reacted and the way our parents treated us and the way we were treated in school and the way our peers treated us and all of that. And then there's, the weather, and there's, you know, the seasons and that kind of thing that impact us. There's the way other people behave that we react to. All of those things I think of as conditions. You know, so the conditions kind of set us up. And then in the moment there is this cause, this momentary, shouldn't be like this right now. Now, we're carrying all that baggage with us, or perhaps any kind of reactivity. You know, it's a rainy day. We don't like rain. We're frustrated. We have to drive in the rain. And so that frustration kind of becomes a filter that we're seeing through. So there's all kinds of conditions that come together. And then in the moment of suffering, there is it's kind of like it's all put together right in a split second. So the conditioning that we have, you know, sometimes we have patterns and habits like that, you know, strong seeing that we've responded this way for our whole lives. And we kind of feel like in some way, well, you know, if I've done that for my whole life, it must still just be there. You know, that it's just me. It's who I am. And it's like I'm carrying this baggage around. And well, the baggage is kind of there in a way, but we're not carrying it around. It's kind of floating along with us. It's like we've got this heavy baggage that is floating next to us. And what happens in a moment is that we go, oh, there's that baggage. I'm going to pick it up. And that's when we suffer. So it's that movement to the picking up of the baggage that in the moment there is that creation of suffering. And so to answer or explore a little bit about what to do, just notice what's obvious. I mean, you've seen a lot happening, you know, a lot of kind of the causes and conditions, and that's helpful. Actually, I find it helpful to see, oh, there's a pattern here. You know, and looking back, it's like, well, of course I'm behaving this way. I mean, look at what happened when I was 10 or whatever, you know. And so it can kind of take a little bit of the charge out of it now. It's like, oh, of course this is the way things are. So it can allow us to be a little more at ease around observing it. But the unmasking of the suffering in the moment just comes through seeing in this moment its creation. And so just be with it. Just watch it as it happens. Can you notice what's obvious about what's happening right now? That's where the unhooking actually happens. We can't undo all of the history, but we can undo the picking up of the history.
Thank you. I hope this was recorded today.
I believe so.
I mean, your talk. I'm going to listen to it again if it was.
And it's 11 o'clock, so we should stop. So sorry about that. Okay.